PRI's Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
From WNYC in New York, I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360.
Hold fast to the right, hold fast to the right.
That is June Carter Cash with Johnny Cash on background vocals. You can hear it on the newly released album The Unbroken Circle, the musical heritage of the Carter family. As one of the most important American musical dynasties from the 1920s through the 1960s, the Carters shared their Appalachian ballads and guitar picking with the world, and music has never been the same.
We got married in a fever.
When Johnny Cash married June Carter in 1968, he became a part of that Carter family legacy.
I'm going to Jackson.
And so did his 12-year-old daughter, Roseanne Cash. Roseanne started performing with her father in her teens in the 1970s, and at age 25 had her first number one hit with 7-Year Ache.
Tell me you're trying to cure a 7-Year Ache. See what else your old heart can take. Boys say, when is he gonna give us some room? But girls say, God, I hope he comes back soon.
Last year, she came out with her first album in 7 years. It includes a duet between Roseanne and her father, Johnny Cash.
When the shadows lengthen and burn away the past, they will fly me like an angel to a place where I can rest.
Johnny Cash died last year, and Roseanne Cash is here with me today to talk about the challenges and opportunities and strange difficulties of being a creative child of a big-time creative family. Roseanne Cash, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you, Kurt. It's a pleasure.
You sing good. That sounded that sounded wonderful.
So, in other words, I chose the right career.
Or the right family, or both, I guess.
The right DNA, maybe.
In that song, you use September as a metaphor for the end of life.
Right.
Which is very haunting. And was September, when it comes, the last collaboration you did with your father?
Yes, it was. And it turned out to be prescient because he died in September. Which is not surprising, because I always had this theory that creative work kind of exists out of the space-time continuum, and that sometimes you write something that's a postcard to your future self, or that just kind of moves along some nonlinear time. That doesn't sound too weird. But my dad was not well when we did that song together, and in fact, the day we recorded, I wasn't even sure whether he was going to be able to. But we did, and he got very enthused about it. And he said, you know, if that's not good enough, I'll come to New York and I'll do it better. So it's great, Dad. It's fine. And it's like the ultimate family photo to me now. I'm glad I have it just for my grandchildren whenever they come.
And given that you have 5 children, I guess you're planning on having a lot of them.
I'm counting on it.
How old were you, or how young were you, when you really woke up and realized that your dad is not just your dad, but this gigantic figure in American music?
I think it was actually a reverse realization, that I realized that everybody else's dads weren't on television and weren't musicians. You know, that I think that realization came young, 7 or 8. Like, oh, he's a bit unusual.
And sometime after that period of 7 or 8, when you woke up and saw that all parents weren't like this and had at least in a kind of nominal sense, an appreciation for who he was on the wider world, at what point after that did you decide, maybe I can do this? Maybe I can have a career in music?
For many years I thought, well, this is the last thing I want to do. You know, I thought being famous was just about the worst thing that could happen to a person. Why would anybody in their right mind want to pursue that?
Why? Why did that seem so bad?
Well, it just seemed awful. My dad was always away. He was always, stretched to the maximum as far as his stamina and his energy and his emotional health and his physical health. And He had constant intrusions on his privacy, and he couldn't go to a movie without people bothering him, you know. And I started thinking that all these people who constantly came up to him were just figures from my subconscious, or maybe his subconscious, and that they were just specters sent to intrude. That sounds awful. So I thought, why would anybody want to have a career where they might get famous? The worst occupational hazard in the world. So
you tried other stuff first?
No, I always knew I wanted to be a writer from a really young age. And that's what I did. And I still, when I started writing songs, I had this kind of agonizing period where I thought, well, am I just going to write songs for other people, or do I want to do them myself?
Was that a process to sort of finally say, okay, this is what I do. I can go on stage. I can be a singer. I can make records.
I had a lot of hubris about being a songwriter. From the very first songs I wrote, I thought they were great. You know, it took me a few years to realize how horrible they were. But it's about going on stage, that took a long time to accept. I just didn't want that much attention. I'm by nature really private and kind of shy, and I just thought, why would I do this? I struggled with myself for years, 20 years, about doing it. It's only, I think, in the last 5 years that I've started to really enjoy it.
What was it like when you first started showing songs that you'd written to your father as a, however old you were?
I was 18. He was incredibly encouraging. You know, he would never say, well, you need to work on that. Or just, he was actually just the total dad in that situation. Oh, you're great, honey. That's wonderful, honey.
That's good.
And then when he saw that I was going into this, that this would be my career, he got a little nervous. He was saying, you know, well, you know, just take care of your children first. That was really the only advice he ever gave me.
Your stepmother, June Carter Cash, was also obviously extraordinarily talented. Did her career and her instrument and all of it have an influence on you as well?
She was key. I don't think I would have been a performer without her. I was scared off by being a performer by what I saw around my dad. But then when I started to know June, I thought, well, now she kind of embraces this so naturally into her life. It's possible to do this and not be destroyed by it. If the family and being on stage and music was all one thing to her. That's what family was.
Did she help? I mean, she was a model. Did she actually give you pointers about you should do this or you should sing this way? Or?
No, she didn't do that. Her sisters, she and her sisters were the ones who taught me to play guitar, and Maybelle as well, and taught me a lot of the
Maybelle
Carter,
her mother,
right, taught me the Carter family songs. And I still play kind of like they do, you know, with that little Carter scratch. She kind of would say, oh, you don't have much of a voice, you know, but you're just going to be great. You know,
she nice. Was,
yeah. She was fantastic.
Roseanne Cash is my guest today. We're talking about having famous artists for parents. And our first story today is about the child of two artists at the top of their game. But Freda Hughes was only 2 years old in 1963 when her mother, the American poet Sylvia Plath, committed suicide. Plath had a conspicuously volatile marriage to the poet Ted Hughes. Freda Hughes has had to jostle with her parents' notorious reputations for her whole life. Sarah Lilly talked with her about how she's coped with the literary establishment and with 40 years of posthumous gossip and glorification of her mother.
Enter the chilly no man's land of precisely 5 o'clock in the morning.
You're hearing a recording of Sylvia Plath reading her poem, The Ghost's Leave-Taking. But for poet and painter Freda Hughes, this sound is the voice of her mother, notoriously deceased before Freda was even 3 years old. Raised and assiduously attended by her equally famous father, the late British poet laureate Ted Hughes, Freda Hughes has had to find her own way as both a daughter and eventually an artist. Just imagine this. You're 14 years old, and your English teacher at school has just assigned everyone to read several poems by your parents.
I bolted it in class, and I couldn't look at them. And I said to the teacher afterwards, I can't do my parents in class. And he said, well, of course you can. You can't be exempt or excused just because they're your parents.
Still, the reality was that in secret, Frieda Hughes was drawn to the same calling.
But it became more and more apparent to me that if I was going to write poetry, I was going to get my head kicked in on a regular basis by everybody who wanted to compare me to my parents.
So at the age of 24, she simply stopped showing anybody anything she wrote. For 10 years.
And in fact, it wasn't until I was 34 and developed chronic fatigue, I made a decision. I thought, okay, I want to write poetry. I do write poetry, but I've never shown anybody. Is the need to do it now, does the need to do it now exceed my fear of the judgment and the comparisons that people will inevitably make? And the need was greater.
Thus, Hughes embarked on her first volume, Waraloo, which was published in 1998. It was named after the Australian village she had been living in at the time, and it was full of fierce observations about the raw power of biological inevitability and decay.
Waraloo, the first book, came out of the recovery from this illness. I just let myself work as much as I need to on all the things I'd sort of forbidden myself. And then, of course, came the comparisons.
For example, the Houston Chronicle published a review which almost bluntly stated that Hughes had pilfered imagery from her parents' poems. For Hughes, this was the most perverse of all, given the degree of restraint she had exercised.
I didn't read my mother's poetry until after I'd written Waraloo, and I didn't read my father's poetry until he gave me his manuscript for Birthday Letters before it was published. I was then entering a world of contemporaries who knew more about my parental history than I did in the literary sense, because I had religiously not studied my parents.
Hughes has dealt with it by continuing to publish her work. Her 2003 collection, Waxworks, is peopled across with historical and mythic figures. Sisyphus, Sweeney Todd, and Vlad the Impaler practically elbow each other into the margins, along with countless others.
I have to say that the poem Madame Tussaud in the Book of Waxworks is really me. Okay, Madame Tussaud. Mary Grossholtz has been shopping. Among the Louis Vuitton handbags, she found Dr. Cripping, his moustache like a zipper, fixing his lips together. She uncovered Durga cradling her corpses in the discounted section of the Army and Navy, nails like penknives blunted by cutting berberis for wreaths. She met Thor in his bare, poor slippers, commiserating with Loki over a vodka and tonic in a London club. And outside, Houdini swinging from a street lamp, screaming for a key to his padlock. Already a collector of heads for her library of faces, she is putting together a family, gathering up the possibilities and taking them home in effigy.
As for her own family growing up, so deeply imbued with the spirit of Plath, Frieda Hughes was able to rely on the devotion of her father to protect her from the bombast of tabloid legend and to fill in the pieces with memories of the actual woman.
I remember once he played a record with her voice. There are things I do remember about my mother and about being with my mother and incidents with my mother. I remember really quite far back.
Go, ghost of our mother and father, ghost of us and ghost of our dreams' children, in those sheets which signify...
Sylvia Plath's revered poetry is something that Hughes has finally allowed herself to experience firsthand. She started reading it seriously within the last few years.
It has been getting close to her, but getting close to her as well at a very poignant, volatile point in her life that would not have continued any more than the volatile, sort of agonized points in my life have not continued. Everything ameliorates and changes and moves on. When the truth of how you feel goes into a poem, you take it, it's like taking a photograph, a freeze frame of your emotional reaction to something. And that truth remains even though you may change afterwards.
And now that Frieda Hughes has reconciled herself fully to understand her lineage, both genetic and literary, she's ultimately managed to find a comfortable place for her own voice.
I don't think we're anything alike poetically. I think she was extraordinary, but learning her that way, and also having read my father's birthday letters now, it's like hearing their conversation across the years. And putting the story together, and out of their story comes my story. And then my story will go on and have its own life.
For Studio 360, I'm Sarah Lilly.
Roseanne Cash is my guest today, and we're talking about having superstar artistic parents. Did that, you nodded a lot during that piece.
Yeah, it was very moving. A lot of things that Frieda Hughes said I could relate to. When she told the story about being assigned to study her parents' poetry in class, I remembered when I was a freshman in high school, my English teacher did this assignment about bringing in literary popular music, and somebody said, what about Johnny Cash? And he said, well, you know, bring in Folsom and San Quentin, but, you know, don't bring in anything else. And I withered in my seat. I was so angry with him.
That seems gratuitous.
It was gratuitous. And then he glanced at me as if he was, you know, getting a dig in. And obviously he was an idiot because, you know, the early stuff of my dad was brilliant.
You also nodded, I noticed, when Frieda Hughes was saying at a certain point one has to decide if she had to decide if her
yes.
need to write poetry was greater than her fear of being compared.
Oh, boy. Absolutely. I think probably everyone who goes into the same field as their parent experiences that. I certainly did.
And does it happen? Did it happen with you in terms of reviews and sort of that kind of coverage?
Not so much because I'm a girl. And, you know, if I had been a boy, I think it would have been brutal. And also because I never traded on my dad. I never tried to compare myself or, you know, use him in any way. And I've always been incredibly cognizant that my dad was a great artist and of only a handful of those come around each century, and the rest of us work with talent, but that there was something special about him.
Roseanne Cash is my guest today, and we are talking about parents. In a minute, Bob Marley's Sons Stir It Up. I'm Kurt Anderson. Stay with us in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International.
Studio 360 is proudly sponsored by Volkswagen of America, a company committed to delivering an innovative driving experience, all the way down to funding what's coming out of your car radio, namely Studio 360. More information at VW.com. And by Powell's Books, an independent bookseller since 1971, now celebrating 10 years online, offering almost 2 million used, new, and out-of-print titles on the web at Powell's.com.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 with the singer-songwriter Roseanne Cash, and we're talking about being a creative person with very famous creative parents. Bob Marley was the undisputed king of reggae music during the 1970s, bringing it to the wide world beyond Jamaica. When he died of cancer in 1981, he was just 36 years old. Marley left behind a large number of songs, a large number of adoring fans, and a rather large number of talented children to try to carry on his legacy. This year, for the first time ever, five of Marley's sons, Ziggy, Stephen, Julian, Kimani, and Damien, are performing on stage together. They're paying tribute to their father on tour with the Bob Marley Roots Rock Reggae Festival. Trey Kaye met up with the brothers backstage at one of their shows in Virginia.
Like me, a lot of music fans might have first heard the intoxicating music of Bob Marley while at a college keg party. If this was the setting, Marley's deep spiritual message and call for social change might have been lost on you. But Marley's eldest son, Ziggy, says that his father wouldn't have been bothered if you considered his music to be party music.
Party music, but it's just party music with a message. You know what I'm saying? Never, don't try for like disrespect the music by saying that, oh, conscious music, you can't party to it. Conscious music is party music.
As a solo artist, Ziggy is the son with the most mainstream success. He has made about 10 major label albums and sings the Arthur theme for the PBS Kids show.
Every day when you're walking down the street, everybody that you meet has an original point of view.
Four of Ziggy's brothers also have solo careers. Stephen and Julian seem to emulate their father's style and sound. Kimani seems like a beefier version of Bob with a boost of vitamins R and B. Damien has a hip-hop dancehall style that bridges his father's message to a more contemporary audience. The heart of Bob Marley's music was his deep Rastafarian beliefs. And it's clear that this message continues in the music of his sons. Most of the people at the Bob Marley Roots Rock and Reggae Festival were born after the reggae star's death. Many of them told me that seeing the sons was the next best thing to seeing the father. I asked Ziggy if he minded being a surrogate to the Bob Marley experience.
Bob Marley experience is not even the Bob Marley experience, it's the Almighty, you know what I'm saying? His thing wasn't about him, it's about Jah, God, you know? So this is where, that is a legacy really, is that liberty, that life. So when you talk of the Bob Marley experience, you're really talking of the Rastaman vibration.
Rastaman vibration, yeah. Live if you wanna live, I and I vibration.
The New York Times said that around the world, Bob Marley may be the most influential musician of the second half of the 20th century. I wondered, when Stephen Marley sits down to write a song, if his father was a daunting standard to measure up to.
No, I mean, measure up. This is my page in the book. It's not measuring, it's a page. I'm a page from the book. And Ziggy's a page from the book. Julian is a page. Damien is a page. What is the book? So we're from one book. So we don't have to measure up.
Some say it's just a part of it. We've got to fulfill the book. Won't you help to sing?
Bob Marley has millions of fans in the American mainstream, despite the fact that there are messages in his music that many might reject. For example, his ample use of marijuana or his open extramarital affairs. In an interview, Marley was asked if he had a queen, and he replied that he was entitled to all the queens.
Do you have a queen?
No, I have one queen. I'm with one queen.
Is he entitled to more than one queen?
Yes, he's entitled to all the queens.
Yeah, well, that's how we're born and we grew up as a family and a unit, even though we have different mothers. We have different mother, but that must not divide us as family, you know, because one father. So we have the unity there from ever since we're children, you know, as a family.
Do you know?
When the Marleys come out for an encore, they play their dad's Could You Be Love. With them, they bring a whole passel of young kids that are the next Marley generation. Can we expect that that there's going to be another generation of Marleys possibly playing music in the future?
Should expect, I mean, you know, should expect. The Almighty have the plan, and that is we just follow what the blueprint says. So if that is the way it is, it will be that way. But we should expect that way from what you see.
For Studio 360, I'm Trey Kay.
Roseanne Cash is my guest today, and we are talking about creative parents. Again, I saw you nodding during that piece about when he said, I think it was Stephen Marley said, about being, he's just a page in the book. He doesn't have to measure up to anything. He's just a page in the book.
That's a great quote. I love that. You know, and I actually did a show with Ziggy a year and a half ago, and I thought he was so great. He had such a beautiful spirit. And what was fascinating about listening to that, you know, the Rastas loved my dad. And he loved them, too. My dad had a home in Jamaica for over 30 years.
Really?
Yeah, so he had a lot of contact with these guys. And
did he ever meet Bob Marley?
Yeah, he did at one point. I remember him talking about him. And I was struck listening to Ziggy talk about how – I was struck with how similar their underlying mission was, you know, if you want to call it a mission, is that they – both Bob and my dad identified so strongly with the spirit – and with a spiritual content and a spiritual emphasis in their work. Even when they're identifying with the dark side, it's obvious that they're trying to find the light. That was always with my dad.
And
I love that.
It's a lot of your father's music, when you listen to it, it's especially compared to the sort of happy pop that we hear today, it's really dark.
It's very dark, right. He was equal parts dark and light, you know, and he was a man of many paradoxes, and that was the beauty in him, is that he could embody all those paradoxes. But also somebody like Bob or like my dad, you know, they belong to the world because they were prototypes. Somebody like me who just works with the gifts I'm given, I don't think I belong to the world. I think I belong to my own life. So I'm happy with the page rather than the whole book.
Well, in addition to the similarity and the parallel in terms of your father and Bob Marley both having this sense of spiritual mission or whatever, they also both had a sense of social mission, obviously. Mm. Your father was very active in prison rights movement and that kind of thing.
Yeah, a lot of things, actually. He was vocal against the Vietnam War. It was very unpopular to do so, and yet he played at the Nixon White House. He performed there. But yet when Nixon asked him to perform Welfare Cadillac, he refused. He took on the Ku Klux Klan. He was very much a social activist. He was fearless.
Given his base, if you will, in the country music world, those were fairly brave positions.
Oh, he didn't think in terms of base. He thought, you know, he was outside genre and he was outside base. And I have contempt for that kind of thinking too.
Of kind of consciously, calculatingly.
Absolutely, to put marketing before everything else. I just, you know, I don't believe in that.
Did he take heat at the time? Did the family take heat at the time for him being anti-war?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Absolutely. And from the Ku Klux Klan as well, you know, there were burnings. There was all kinds of crap that went on. But, you know, he had the courage of his convictions.
Roseanne Cash is my guest today in Studio 360, and we are talking about famous creative parents. Our next story is told by the daughter of the beat writer Jack Kerouac. Kerouac was best known for his 1957 novel On the Road, which is the celebrated artifact of the beat movement. Not surprisingly, Jack Kerouac was nobody's family man. Jan Kerouac only met her father twice, and as an adult, she struggled to understand him and his art and her relationship to him. In fact, she sometimes talked about changing her name. In 1989, 20 years after his death, Jan heard an old recording of Jack Kerouac giving a talk, and radio producer Marjorie Van Hultren asked her to write a poem in response to it. They recorded it one cold winter night in New York City.
Beat generation. Beat generation. That nutty picture of me on the cover of On the Road results from the fact that I had just gotten down from a high mountain where I'd been for 2 months completely alone.
Hey, Jack. Hey, Jack. Is that you? This is Jan Michelle, your daughter. Remember?
The question is very silly because we should be wondering tonight, is there a world?
Hey, Jack.
But I could go and talk for 5, 10, 20 minutes about is there a world. Because there is really no world. But sometimes I'm walking on the ground and I see right through the ground. And there is no world.
I believe we met twice down in the stew pot. Yeah, it's me.
Oh, this all goes back to the inky ditties of old cartoons.
I'd like to talk to the cat that begat me.
Felix the cat with the irrational brick.
You dig?
Laurel and Hardy in the foreign region.
I heard your voice come over the line from out there in black telephone universe
and
land.
Our fathers wore straw hats like WCT.
And I felt like the RCA Victor dog.
And all he wanted me to do was speak out my mind against people. He sneeringly brought up Dulles, Eisenhower, the Pope, the Thomas, all kinds of people like that. Habitually that he would
oh,
at
to be a gleeful mad boy.
The world he wanted. This is his idea.
Back
of
the mists of innocence.
But who knows, my God, but that the universe is not one vast sea of compassion, actually?
A beat still incubating in the unsullied womb of beathood, where the only specters of doom were two bald-headed cats who, like, could push a button and blow us all out of here, man.
Essence of everything, Mama.
And now those imagined antics of Khrushchev and Ike have long since dissolved in the serum of history.
Nay, the true pure foreverhood.
Immortalized by Mad Magazine, which I used to steal from the corner candy store. H-bombs drawn in so many cartoons has become a cartoon. Or at most, the smallest measurement of nuclear firepower on Earth.
Why should I attack what I love all my life? This is deep. Live your lives out? Ah, love your lives out.
No one seems to realize it, but I'll tell you a secret. H-bomb, I think, is the success secret of Japan. Yeah.
This is 2,500 years old. Mm-hmm.
If one of those sweet, beatitudinous babes of yore had stood up and prophesied that in 3 decades an Iranian fanatic would hold the entire publishing world hostage, if he had said that there'd be Haitian drug gangs called posses in Kansas City, or condoms advertised on TV, computer viruses, hypos handed out on street corners.
It goes back to the holy old Arab, warning the hot bloods that Ramadan is near.
If he had dared to suggest that in the late 80s,
the war on the hot bloods,
Soviets would be more peace-minded than the Americans, and that there would be a huge hole in the ozone, from spray cans.
Why don't you come back in a million years and tell me all about it, Angel?
They would have put him in a straitjacket and carted him away to an asylum.
And our fathers wore straw hats like WCT.
And there in the nut house, he might have written a monstrous work of fantasy science fiction to make George Orwell's 1984 look like The Wizard of Oz by comparison.
In fact, here is a poem I've written about Harpo Marx.
Ah, my poor father. He's such a big baby noodle brain. Too noodle brain to exist in this world of geometric fear. Too animal saintly headed, too animal saintly hooded. Was too saintly to crawl through those concrete rat mazes of tortured thought. I know, I'm the same kind of baby noodle brain, because I can feel him in my bones. I'm getting to know him. I'm getting to know little boy Bean from inside out. Racing down, down, madly southward on Madison Avenue through Manhattan today. Breezing in the cruel cold, I wrap myself up like an Arab. Blue hat and scarf like veils and, while rushing, caught a glimpse of myself in store windows. Like a mad Tuareg or Berber tribesman of the Sahara, hurtling at full tilt on a horse or maybe even a camel. Turquoise shrouds and veils flapping in the hot desert wind. Only this was cold city wind here on the other side of the Atlantic, which reminded me of the ancient sunken home of continental driftwood, continental breakfast hood.
Walking, talking poetry in the streets, walking, talking God in the streets.
Oh, we humans must be a pretty hardy lot to swarm all over this poor old globe time after time, strong as dynasties of cockroaches in those tenements I used to live in. Remember, Jack, you came to visit me in a tenement? I bet you didn't see any cockroaches. No, you were too drunk. Well, never mind. Anyway, so, you say, All your fathers wore straw hats like W.C. Fields. Well, I wish I could say that, but you see, my father was the invisible man. But I won't hold that against you.
You're not listening. The poem goes, love's multitudinous boneyard of decay. The spilled milk of heroes. Destruction of silk kerchiefs by dust storm. Arrest of heroes, blindfolded hosts. Murder victims admitted to this life. Skeletons bartering fingers and joints.
Poet Jan Kerouac and her father, Jack Kerouac. Jack Kerouac died in 1969 at 47. Jan Kerouac died in 1996. She was 44 years old. Roseanne Cash is my guest today, and we're talking about creative parents. That's a very sad piece on several levels.
It made me very uncomfortable, actually. It seemed nihilistic.
And I mean, in this case, unlike you, who were, maybe your father was touring and traveling a lot, but you had a real relationship.
A real relationship, right. And that with Freda Hughes and with Ziggy Marley, you know, I also realized that I felt real gratitude that I knew my dad until he was 71 years old. It's a blessing. And that we had a great relationship.
It seems to me, some anger was fueling that.
Some?
that piece. Did you ever feel anything that ferocious towards your father?
No, because she sounds very bitter. It doesn't sound like clean anger. You know, I mean, how could it be clean? She never had a chance to work it out with him, right? This is all just in her own head. It's a specter she's talking to. My dad and I, thankfully, worked it out. And when he died, we were very close. So I don't have regrets like that.
Is there any specific memory you have of going through that process of working it out with your father?
Yeah, there is. It's about 96 or 97. He was performing at Carnegie Hall. And I was going through a period in my life where I was angry with him. You know, like all of the childhood resentments had surfaced at that point, and I had stuff I needed to talk to him about. And he asked me if I would sing with him at Carnegie Hall that night. And I was just angry at him. I said, no, I've got a headache. I don't want to. He's kind of just nodded and said, okay. And so then the next day I came back, the day of the show, I came into his hotel room and he asked me again. And again I said no, I was still angry. And he got up and he said, okay, you know, I just accepted it. He walked away and there was just something about the look of his back that I had seen on stage a million times, that back framed in spotlight. And it just broke my heart. And I called after him. I said, Dad, I'll do it. So we sang I'll Still Miss Someone that night at Carnegie Hall. And it was a transcendent moment. It was like everything was washed clean. And it made me realize that the stage is where my dad worked out all of his deep problems and where he got healed. And there was a space to contain me in that night. It was beautiful. It was a really sweet moment.
Do you have that sense in your own life of real important psychodramas being worked out on stage?
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, even if it's all in my own head, you know, it's what you bring to the spotlight is, you know, either your best self or your worst self, or at least can reflect something you might not see in your everyday life because it's heightened. It's a heightened moment.
Roseanne Cash is my guest. We will be back in a minute, and she's going to play a song for us. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International.
At my door the leaves are falling. A cold wild wind will come. Sweethearts walk by together. And I still miss someone. I go out on a party and look for a little fun, but I find a darkened corner.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 with Roseanne Cash, and we're talking about growing up with famous parents. Once you were established as a musician, Roseanne, and you sort of had to build an adult relationship as a musician with your famous musician father, was that a separate sort of parallel track of working things out from just being a daughter and a father?
Well, I know I withdrew from my dad somewhat in my late 20s, early 30s, when I was really kind of trying to establish myself. I felt I just needed to get out of his shadow and do this on my own. And he was respectful of that. I think sometimes it might have hurt him a little, like that he knew what I was doing, but maybe he wished that I wouldn't separate so much.
What form did that take?
Well, you know, I just didn't call him as much and didn't go over. And, you know, I think it was a normal phase of development that you go through in your 20s. So, and I think he knew that too. But, yeah, there were parts of our relationship that were kind of professional, that were a way to be close, that, you know, was really satisfying. Like when I recorded his song Tennessee Flat Top Box, and it was a number one record, and he was very excited because he wrote the song, and I was very excited because I sang the song, and, you know, it was a moment to bond over that, and that was good. It was added.
In a little cabaret in a South Texas border town sat a boy and his guitar, and the people came from all around, and all the girls from there to Austin were slipping away from home and putting jewelry in hot to take the trip.
And as you begin collaborating in performance in the studio, did you get to know him in ways other than you had as a daughter?
We didn't collaborate that much. There were only a very few isolated instances that were special. September, when it comes to being the last and most poignant and most important to me, too. But, you know, as my dad grew older, to see him in a working environment became more and more touching to me, and his frailties becoming more obvious, and the fact that he had been doing this for so long, and it was his home, you know, the road and the stage were his home, and how comfortable he was there. So it opened my heart to my dad in ways that perhaps wouldn't have been available, you know, in normal circumstances. But also his genuineness and his sweetness just in the privacy of his little office, you know, sitting with his books was very precious to me. I really came to value all of it, both sides of him. But he, more and more, who he was in that little office was who he was on stage or out in the world. The two kind of merged completely at some point in his later years.
You said when you were just starting out and he'd read your songs and he'd just be a good dad, saying, "That's great, honey." After you were actually successful and had number one hits and all of it, what kind of pleasure did he take in your success?
Then he would call me as an artist and talk about the work, you know, like when I made Interiors and it was kind of a cataclysmic moment in my career because I produced this record myself, wrote it myself. I delivered it to the record company, and they kind of went, well, we don't know what to do with this. This won't get country radio airplay. So I was transferred to New York, to the pop division of the label. And then, of course, all these stories came out that I had left country music as if it were a religion or a state. And my dad called me up during all the midst of this. He said, I'm really proud of you. This is the best work you've ever done. I'm so glad. Yes, you need to get out of here. This is the right thing to do. Everybody else was criticizing me, but my dad gave me that support. And then
that was important support at that moment?
Incredibly important. I was floundering. It was really important. So that kind of stuff. And then he would call and talk about the songs. And then with Rules of Travel, he called after he heard the whole record and he said, I'm really proud of September When It Comes. He said, but I'm most proud of it in the context of the whole record. And that meant the world to me. He couldn't have said anything better.
So it sounds like not only did he do not a terrible job of raising you, but certainly in the last 5 or 10 years of his life, your life together, he did all that he could to, you know, give you the necessary pats on the back.
He did. I mean, he wrote me a letter that just, it ended in 97. He wrote this letter. It's the last sentence was write, and never care what they say. You know, that's a mandate.
As you came into your own fully as a performer and a writer and a success, did you come to any new understanding of him as of Johnny Cash as an artist and a person?
Well, I came to realize what I said earlier, that there's only a few like him in a generation that are great artists who belong to the world and who have a mission that's greater than their own ego and their own needs and their own gifts even. But I also came to realize how extraordinary he was in that he could have so easily self-destructed, channeling that kind of creative energy. Most people don't have an ego that could contain it. And he almost did destroy himself because of that. And that he pulled up, you know, his tremendous resources to save himself. You know, there was a mythic story about how June saved him from drugs. Nobody can save you from drugs. He saved himself with his, you know, his brand of his own faith. And so just that insight into what an incredibly strong and person he was and how committed he was to his mission, that he was going to stay on the planet. I have nothing but respect for that, and also for the fact that he never made anyone pay for his pain. And to me, that's the definition of integrity, is that he could hold his own darkness and his own pain and not blame anyone else for it, or even make them pay for it in the vicinity of it.
Really? So he had his anguish and his darkness, but he didn't create a hell on earth for the people around him?
Absolutely not. He showed nothing but respect and kindness.
That is the definition of character.
That's right.
I would love it if you would play a song for us now.
Sure.
And what are you going to play?
Well, since I've talked so much to you about September When It Comes, I thought I would play that.
Great.
There's a cross above the baby's bed, a savior in dreams, but she was not delivered then, and the baby became me. But there's a light inside a darkened room, a footstep on the stair, door that I forever close to leave those memories there. So when the shadows lengthen into an evening sun, well, first there's summer, then I'll let you in, September.
to crawl outside these walls. Close my eyes and see. Fall into the heart and arms of those who wait for me. I cannot move a mountain now. I can no longer run. I cannot be who I was then in a way I never was. I watch the clouds go sailing. Watch the clock and sun. Oh, I watch myself depending on September when it comes. When the shadows lengthen and burn away the past, well, they will fly me like an angel to a place where I can rest. When this begins, I'll let you in September. When it comes.
Roseanne Cash singing the beautiful song, September When It Comes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Are you working on a new record now?
I am. I've written about three quarters of it. It's called Black Cadillac. It's a record about loss and death, but it's not as grim as it might sound, because it's also about personal history and about how relationships continue even after death.
At least, you mean in one's own heart and mind? Or
I think
more
so.
Than that?
Even more than that. I think that relationships that are founded on love, that they don't stop if one person leaves the planet. And, you know, the readjustment period is hell, but it goes on, you know. I feel my dad around me, and I think he communicates, and I communicate with him. He used to love it in the last year of his life when I read the Psalms to him. So sometimes I get up in the morning and I read a Psalm to him. I say, "There you go, Dad."
Now,
yeah.
Now that you have been a mother yourself for 30,
many years,
many years.
Many years.
Have you learned things by being a parent, being a mother, that have changed the way you regard your father, your mother, your stepmother in retrospect?
Well, being a parent, you know this. The first thing you learn is how much your own parents love you, because you know how much you love your own child. I've learned a lot. I think I've learned more from my kids than I did from my parents. You know, just about stability, love, the nature of love, and how to be a parent and not a friend, and, you know, how to put your own ego aside for 5 minutes, and how to give them your pencil even if you're using it, and, you know, sacrifice.
Do they, any of them, have any inklings in the direction of being writers, artists, singers?
One of them does. I don't know about my 5-year-old son. I mean, he knows the entire Beatles catalog by heart, so I fear for him greatly. But my 22-year-old daughter is writing songs now and, you know, forming a band and everything. And the most interesting thing, she called me a few weeks ago, and we had the conversation that I had with someone when I was 22, the exact conversation about fear of the public life, but this passionate desire to be a musician and write songs, and how to reconcile the two.
And you're not warning her off it?
No, I said, I understand. I had the exact same feelings. And, you know, I struggled with it for many years. But there's a way to do it and not destroy yourself. One thing I do is I live in New York City. You know, anonymity can be
bought. People don't know who you are or care who you are?
If they do know and they do care, they are so cool about it. They'll just kind of stand next to you on the corner while you're waiting across the street and go, you know, saw you on Letterman last night. You were cool. And then walk off.
Roseanne Cash, thank you very much for coming to Studio 360 today.
It's my pleasure, Kurt. I enjoyed it.
Roseanne Cash is a writer and singer. Her next record, Black Cadillac, will come out in the spring.
Yes, probably March.
She also has a track on the new album, Unbroken Circle, the musical heritage of the Carter family. You can find out more about her and her parents and her stepmother at studio360.org. And before you go, I would love it if you could play one more song for us, maybe something by your father.
Oh, sure. I'll play something of his. I close my eyes and picture the emerald of the sea from the fishing boats at Dingle to the shores of Dunedee. I miss the River Shannon, the folks at Skibbereen, the moorlands and the meadows with their 40 shades of green. But most of all, I miss a boy in Tipperary town. And most of all, I miss his lips as soft as eiderdown. Again, I want to see and do the things we've done and seen, where the breeze is sweet as Shalimar and there's 40 shades of green.
That was Roseanne Cash singing her father Johnny Cash's song, 40 Shades of Green. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC along with PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
David Krasnow,
Lital Mulad,
Michelle Siegel,
Ave Carrillo,
Benjamin Shaw,
Elizabeth Daly,
Kate Saramek.
Our theme music was composed by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Additional support for Studio 360 is provided by Volkswagen of America, a company committed to delivering an innovative driving experience, all the way down to funding what's coming out of your car radio, namely Studio 360. More information at VW.com. And by Powell's Books, an independent bookseller since 1971, now celebrating 10 years online, offering almost 2 million used, new, and out-of-print titles on the web at Powell's.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.